Thank you very much. It's a great honor to get to be here today. Very much appreciate it. This is not going to be anywhere near as inspiring as our last talk on virtue, because I'm going to be down in these ugly, grotty trenches with the acquired virtue people, which is where I spend most of my professional life, actually. I work in virtue ethics. Most mainstream philosophers and social scientists working in this area use Aristotle as a guide to guide them in thinking about virtue. I'm currently on a small crusade to help build interest in using Thomas Aquinas instead. Aquinas's work on virtue is of a piece with his theology, of course, and that's part of the reason he's received less attention from contemporary thinkers and researchers studying virtue outside the confines of specifically Christian moral philosophy. But his understanding of acquired virtue, what it is and what it does, is helpful, I think, even if we don't share his faith, and his work on the nature and structure of the virtues takes us well beyond anything we have in Aristotle, even though Aristotle's work provides the material, some of the material at least, from which Aquinas develops his work on acquired virtue. Now, I'm going to give a kind of quick tour through the basic structure and thrust of Thomist acquired virtue theory today, with all respect to those who notice that this cannot possibly be the whole story in Aquinas' life. As a starting point, consider the phrase darkened intellect, disturbed passions, and disordered will as a description of how things are for human beings generally. For some, the phrase has theological significance and points to the fall from grace. For others who occasionally read the newspaper, watch television, or lament things that family members, friends, neighbors, civic leaders, and other people do, the phrase may be no more than a concise description of our lot. It is often hard for us to direct our energies toward long-term, lasting good when doing so would prevent us from pursuing more immediate gains, or toward the common good when that looks to be at odds with private advantage. This is a way of summarizing the trouble, not just when we lie, cheat, steal, or commit acts like murder, rape, fraud, or torture on however small or grand a scale, but also in the thousand small occasions when we are impatient, selfish, moody, dishonest, ungenerous, overly generous, or foolish. What interests me about these things is not the breathtaking commonality of bad judgment, bad responses, bad habits, and bad deeds. It is rather the extraordinary fact that perfectly ordinary people know better. We may not put this knowledge to good use. We may not seek to improve our own characters and actions, but we know better. And because we know better, we also know to be struck by our fellows' patience, kindness, honesty, justice, and courage. Given that one can notice the descriptive accuracy of the phrase darkened intellect, disturbed passions, and disordered will without adverting to revealed knowledge about God's acts, the fact that we know better should be striking. It could be objected that this is a merely conceptual point. The phrase is about privation. It's not possible to understand privation without trying to frame some account of the good that's blocked, impeded, or otherwise made less by privation. Perhaps people are just picking up on the implicit contrast. I mean, that could be. Picking up on the implicit contrast could even be how we know what to criticize in others. But we also use points summarized in this phrase against ourselves. Anyone who has deployed such material self-critically will understand the peculiar form of apparently self-generated and appropriate humility that comes of vivid appreciation of her or his own failings. The only way to make sense of this experience is to suppose that we are not utterly benighted. Some spark, some bright corner carries an understanding of the way in which we are, frankly, a mess by carrying some sense of what things might be if we were well ordered. assuming, as seems to me entirely plausible, that none of us has much experience with an entirely well-governed human being, we should be at least as struck by the fact that we know better as we are by the fact that we frequently fall short. For Aquinas, cultivation of acquired virtue helps to remedy this situation, and even though very few of us will develop harmonious, reasonable, practical orientations directed at good and governed by the highest good, with or without discipline and training, Aquinas, like Aristotle, takes it that we are nevertheless drawn that way. Fundamentally, we seek to pursue good and avoid evil, which is why we have it in us to work to improve ourselves in the first place, just as part of ordinary nature, I think. Okay, for Aquinas, human nature as we know it is fallen nature. We are, he thinks, operating at a loss. Aquinas thought that original sin deprived humankind of original justice, as he says over and over again. Now, how did things stand for us before the fall, according to Aquinas? Eileen Sweeney puts the point this way, quote, "What is strange about Aquinas' view is that a purely natural state of humankind has, strictly speaking, never existed. Before the fall, nature had a kind of supernatural strength, and after that, nature is somewhat, though not radically, depleted," close quote. The supernatural strength in original justice was a matter of orientation and governance. The human's higher powers were subjected to God, the lower powers to the higher powers, and the body to the soul. Aquinas adds a fourth subjection in his commentary on Romans. Before the fall, exterior things were subject to humankind, such that they served the human, and the human was not harmed by them. Like Adam could not have stubbed his toe, in a certain sense. In the prelapsarian condition, perfect rectitude of the will was possible. In the prelapsarian condition, humans could act on their innate love of God without impeding themselves. This is the sense in which the gift of original justice perfects human nature. It places our powers in proper order, given the kind of creatures we are. Now, if we're committed to working on virtue, without adverting to any tendentious religious views, it may seem that we should ignore work on fallen human nature. We don't think there was any prior state of grace from which we fell. We don't think that being able to act from love of God without impediment constitutes the appropriate condition for a human being. This is most of my colleagues. What I'm describing to you is most of my colleagues. I don't use the word secular to describe them because I'm an American. Secular means more than one sect. I don't like to use it as a euphemism for atheist or godless. But most of my colleagues are godless or atheists or something like that. Which is why they don't think that being able to act from love of God without impediment constitutes the appropriate condition for the human being. I mean, so with these guys, I have to leave God to one side. We could notice, for those folks, they could notice that as far as we know, humans are the most psychologically complex animals. Animals capable of so altering the world in which they find themselves that they change the climate. Of finding themselves volitionally and emotionally frozen in the face of a thought, or filled with joy or sorrow or fear over a movie, a story, a song, or the view. Why wouldn't such organisms find self-governance and an overall orderly, positive, practical direction hard to achieve, quite apart from the vicissitudes of fortune? In Aquinas' view, order is what was lost to the species at its ancestral source through original sin. It seems plausible to suggest that, apart from revelation, there's no reason to think that perfect order was ever our ordinary condition. It's our faith that tells us that there ever was such a thing for a human being. If we find ourselves with a darkened intellect, disturbed passions, and a disordered will, our powers are not properly arraigned or aligned. Now, it could be argued that inordinate inclinations or passions somehow cloud the intellect seriously enough to pervert judgment and so make the intellect dark. Those clouds are the source of the darkness. Perhaps this is what disorders the will. There are, of course, passages in Aquinas that suggest this, and certainly a lot of the symptoms that point to the disarray at issue in the phrase look to involve excessive or deficient passions or inclinations. I will urge a slightly different interpretation of Aquinas' map of where we land after the fall. The interpretation is really simple. What's lost is original justice. Original justice is an ordering of mentality and will that allows us to direct ourselves to God appropriately. The darkening of the intellect consists in our finding ourselves in a situation where the intellect is no longer directed to God, the lower powers are no longer subject to reason, the body is no longer subject to the soul or the mind in the appropriate way. Just as the first is the most important in original justice, its loss is the most important loss incurred through original sin. Rational appetite no longer effectively operates in and from the highest register of practical wisdom. Because of this, the passions are disturbed. Although it is most common to emphasize the ramifications of the loss of original justice in terms of the loss of the downward subjections, intellect to good, lower powers to higher powers, body to soul, like one could just as easily emphasize the upward inclination toward good that is impeded by the loss of original justice. Impediment is not the same as obliteration. The corrective supplied by acquired virtues like temperance, fortitude, justice, and practical wisdom or prudence is meant to address the loss of the kind of governance proper to our natures given the kinds of creatures we are. To begin to lay the groundwork to reintegrate our powers, or at least foster cooperation among them in a way that helps rectify the will. In effect, for our kind of intellect, the sort that an animal can embody, and for our kind of animal, the sort endowed with intellect as such oriented to the highest good possible for us, the darkening of the intellect is the loss of the order in inclination and governance that helps us to direct ourselves to the goods it belongs to us to pursue. According to Aquinas, at least on my reading, the complexity of human nature as we know it is such that we share some tendencies with other animals and other tendencies with angels. Aquinas, for example, quotes Gregory with approval, quote, man senses in common with the brutes and understands with the angels, close quote. But in trying to get a grip on this and many other passages, it is tremendously important to pin down what is supposed to be shared across diverse kinds of creatures and how. And here, I think, the fact that Aquinas recognizes more than one kind of cognition is a tremendous philosophical advantage. Now, most contemporary philosophers in my field use the terms reason and rational to cover many aspects of specifically and distinctively human mentality. The term covers at least the whole of what gets translated as reason, understanding, and intellect in Aquinas' writings about us. The standard philosophical view has it that many species of animals have fundamentally similar powers of sense and appetite, but that humans have an extra power, reason, that is, as it were, added on to the animal to give us the human. Cutting-edge analytic neo-Aristotelians nowadays reject this picture because they think that it is a mistake to treat reason as though it were, in Matthew Boyle's phrase, an add-on. Boyle distinguishes what he calls additive accounts of reason from transformative accounts. He writes, and this is the long and most complicated quote on your handout, the crucial difference between additive and transformative theorists is not that additive theorists admit, whereas transformative theorists deny, that the minds of rational and non-rational creatures have something in common. Additive theorists advocate a certain way of understanding what we have in common with non-rational animals. They hold that there must be a distinguishable factor in rational powers of perception and action, which is of the very same kind as the factor which wholly constitutes merely animal powers of perception and action. Transformative theorists, by contrast, locate the similarity between rational and non-rational mentality in a different explanatory structure. They hold that rational mentality and non-rational mentality are different species of the genus of animal mentality. What the two have in common on this view is not a separable factor that's present in both, but a generic structure that is realized in fundamentally different ways in the two cases. Rational and non-rational animals do not share in the sensory and cognitive powers of non-rational animals. They share in the sensory and cognitive powers of animals, where this is a generic category of power that admits of two fundamentally different sorts of realization. Close quote. This is a very different understanding of the way in which we sense with the brutes than the understanding that holds that the cats and humans who live in my apartment have the same animal mentality, but that the humans have reason added on top of that in some way that accounts for the difference between ordering a burger at a restaurant and meowing when hungry. Now, there are many passages in Aquinas that look to be amenable to an additive interpretation of Aquinas' account of human mentality, but there also are many that do not. Some of the most powerful, interestingly, from my point of view, are in the Christology. And when Aquinas discusses the power of the soul, powers of the soul, it seems to me fairly clear that his focus is on what Boyle calls generic categories that admit of fundamentally different kinds of realization. Consider, for example, the varieties of realization at issue in inclination or tendency or appetite for Aquinas. Even if, as Anthony Kenny recommends, we confine our attention to Aquinas' thought about living things and reject an Aristotelian metaphysics that gives us fire tending toward heaven and stones tending toward earth, I mean, it's not actually clear to me that any account of movement or change involving middle-sized physical objects can do without tendencies. I think you actually need them. Aquinas is right. Aquinas seems to have what Boyle calls general categories of processes in view and to be alive to radical differences in the way these are realized in different kinds of creatures. Aquinas even has the material necessary to hold that reason, at least as contemporary analytic philosophers use that term, is a category that admits of fundamentally different sorts of realization. Angelic intellect, for example, is fundamentally different from human intellect in Aquinas. And Aquinas allows for varieties of non-human animal something like reason as well. Angels may be the only non-human creatures endowed with what Aquinas calls intellect, and are certainly the only non-human creatures he credits with free will, but they're not the only cognitively complex non-human creatures. It's not that our somehow non-human modes of appetite and sense took the reins through original sin and so clouded the clean, cool operations of distinctively human reason. I may become ferocious over some things, but my fury is human fury, not the ferocity of a mother bear protecting her cubs. On the transformative interpretation, if I am by turns cowardly and foolishly bold, I am experiencing and acting from specifically human cowardice and specifically human rashness. Notice that what counts as cowardly in one of us may have no counterpart among other animals. Consider, adult human beings can make themselves sick with worry over the prospect of hurting someone's feelings, or can convince themselves that the need to avoid such a calamity is reason enough to tell lies. Even if other kinds of animals sometimes deliberately mislead, it is hard to imagine a non-human animal doing so for fear of hurting another creature's feelings. This is us, not them. Okay. That's not what the coyote is up to when it tries to get you to follow it. Okay. I have focused on inordinate irascibility. The same holds true, I think, for inordinate concupiscence. Narrowly, on the best account I can see of it, and the one frequently, I think, at work in Aquinas, concupiscence concerns the appetite for delight as such, with special emphasis on sensual delight. It helps to remember that temperance is supposed to moderate sense appetite, not obliterate it, just as fortitude is supposed to moderate irascibility rather than destroy it. Aquinas takes it that there cannot be such a thing as a natural inclination toward good or away from bad that's somehow inherently wicked. Concupiscence and irascibility are inclinations toward good, away from or against bad, especially sensible good and bad, but on the transformative interpretation, these will be inflected by reason even if they are not obedient to reason. On the transformative interpretation, the force of inordinate in discussions of passions and actions is disorderly, given the kinds of creatures that we are. The point of calling some aspects of our nature higher and others lower on the transformative interpretation is to signal that some aspects of our nature are supposed to at once regulate and attract other aspects. So, for us, qua intellectual creatures, the practical requirement to pursue good and avoid bad points to the need to direct ourselves toward what will perfect creatures of our kind as best we can understand that. I mean, we can't get there under our own steam, of course. What we really perfect, we need, is gratuitous. Like all organisms, we need to maintain ourselves and to reproduce. Like all mammals, we need to care for our offspring. Appropriately regulated human desire ought to direct us toward what conduces to these things and turn us away from or against what blocks or impedes them. As human beings, we need the society of our fellow human beings. Again, reason and desire, suitably directed by justice, ought to enable us to enjoy well-ordered human society. As intellectual creatures, we need what reason shows us is the highest good, and this need is meant to help us regulate, order, and coordinate our activities and pursuits. It is not a separate need that sits off at a distance from the others. All of these needs are the needs of imperfect beings for what will complete or perfect them. What will complete or perfect any imperfect being just is what will complete or perfect a being of its kind. The striving toward perfection is not obliterated by original sin. What is lost is, instead, original justice as the condition in which the human's longing for its own fulfillment and completion governed the whole of its operations. On the transformative reading of Aquinas, the job of acquired virtues is to foster cooperation of the specifically human beings' higher and lower powers in an overall pursuit of specifically human good, and so offer a partial correction to our disordered mentality, will, and acts. Seven virtues are the most important acquired virtues for Aquinas, are the most important virtues for Aquinas, the four cardinal virtues, practical wisdom, justice, temperance, and fortitude, together with the three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity. For atheist neo-Aristotelians, the cardinal virtues are going to be the more interesting. Even though for the rest of us, the others are at least as important, probably more. Aquinas thinks that he takes from Aristotle, as near as I can tell, an account of four acquired virtues as the principal acquired virtues. Prudence or practical wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance. Aquinas spells out in some detail why these are cardinal virtues and how we need all of them to act without impeding ourselves. Following Aristotle broadly, Aquinas takes it that a virtue brings the full and appropriate actualization of a human power, or at least goes toward that, one that allows both the upward inclination of passions and appetite toward reason and good and the downward governance of passion and appetite by reason and good to be actualized in the overall pursuit of a good human life. Michael Pakaluk puts the point this way, quote, "A virtue is a trait that makes someone such that his activity, what he does, what he's responsible for, is reasonable. But there are four basic types of such activity: his thinking itself as practical and directed at action, his actions, ordinarily so called, and how he is affected. This last category splits into two, Aquinas thinks, on the grounds that acting reasonably in the realm of the passions involves regulating both the passions by which we're drawn to something and the passions by which we're repulsed from something. These two sorts of passions imply two sorts of tasks or achievement, which the ordinary distinction between the virtues of temperance and fortitude or courage confirms. Close quote. Aquinas' account of acquired virtue relies heavily on these points from Aristotle. Aristotle's work is broadly consistent with treating prudence as the virtue responsible for sound practical thinking and judgment. It's a virtue of the intellect directed to the will. Justice, for Aquinas at least, is a virtue of the will directed at extramental actions, primarily those that concern giving each his due. Jean Porter underscores this point and urges taking its full generality seriously. Quote, "As a virtue of the will, justice is the only cardinal virtue which directly concerns the distinctively human capacity for rational desire. Moreover, it is the cardinal virtue directly concerned with external actions, and as such, it includes most of the norms of non-maleficence and respect for others." Close quote. As Pakaluk noted, temperance and courage are virtues of passion. Temperance renders attractions to desirable things reasonable. Courage is charged with reasonable aversion, principally with controlling for fear so that we can be appropriately steadfast. Crudely then, prudence corrects for darkened intellect in the practical sphere, begins to make that correction anyway. Temperance encouraged for some of the disturbances in the passion, and justice for some of the disorder in the will. Aquinas thinks that he takes from Aristotle an understanding of prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude as four cardinal principal acquired virtues, all of which should be cultivated in leading a good human life. Again, all in acquired virtue, the ruddy part, the down dirty part. Now, contemporary virtue theorists recognize many virtues that played no part in Aristotle's work at all. Hope, for example, and humility and gratitude. If you're in the UK and you're a social scientist or a philosopher or somebody else working on virtues, you're going to be really interested in hope, humility, and gratitude. If you belong to that group in the United States, interestingly, you're going to be interested in something called resilience and something called grit. Like, you know, cowboys versus gentlemen or something. It's really kind of an interesting, just across the Atlantic, sort of a difference. Okay, I'm not going to talk about resilience and grit, which is a little harder to fit entirely into Aquinas, although the resilience stuff finds a lot of place in a lot of room in a lot of places. Okay, for Aquinas, hope, of course, belongs among those strengths of character that are divinely infused. Given that most of my audience is usually a bunch of atheists, I'm going to leave that to the side for the moment. Humility and gratitude, however, can count as acquired secondary virtues in Aquinas. Secondary virtues are annexed to cardinal virtues to fortify and assist in the operation of the cardinal virtues. All acquired virtues, cardinal and secondary, have their source in our efforts to build better character, their object in a more proper order of human mentality and action, and their good in a good individual temporal life. Unsurprisingly, Aquinas treats gratitude as properly annexed to justice. The virtue that in England they name humility involves aspects of justice that Aquinas treats under the headings of religion, piety, and respectfulness for those in authority. As is true for hope in Aquinas and for any acquired virtue on his scheme, gratitude and humility also may be treated as virtues that go beyond anything We can conjure on our own through discipline and training, beyond any strength directed at the good temporal life for an individual human being, understood as sort of an ordinary sense of contentment, satisfaction, what have you. They may be treated as virtues whose objects and aims involve goods beyond temporal happiness. Such are the infused virtues in Aquinas. Hope is, of course, an infused virtue, a gift from God, with God as its object and beatific union as its end. All of the acquired cardinal virtues have infused counterparts in Aquinas' scheme. Now, this aspect of Aquinas' thought has been the subject of an enormous amount of controversy among scholars of late, even scholars who are very friendly to Aquinas in general. I agree with those who argue that infused virtue is indispensable for Aquinas. Given the object, source, and end of infused virtues, atheist moral philosophy cannot adopt Aquinas' work on the topic at all, really. I mean, there is one aspect of the work that he does on infused virtue that might find a home in standardly atheistic virtue theory. It's not in any sense a central aspect of Aquinas' view. It's just a little bit you could give to the non-believers in labs all over the place. Okay. So, return for a moment to Aquinas on the loss of original justice. In the more than merely natural state of original justice, all the powers characteristic of human nature were well ordered, and this affected all the operations of the thereby integrated human being. I take it that the chief sense in which our intellect is darkened through original sin is just this: original sin impedes the ordering of reason to the highest good, to God, really. As such, it impedes the coordinated operations of all other aspects of human mentality in the service of genuine good. Infused virtue is a gift from God. It takes God as its object and union with God as its end. Put into terms of what Thomists treat as temporal life, human life as we know it, in human life as we know it and live it, some virtues are oriented to higher goods, goods that go beyond the flourishing, even the capacities of an individual human being, goods that are inherently transcendent. In this sense, acquired gratitude is going to focus on goods we have as specific benefits given to us personally by other people. Right, personally by other people. It has a sort of triadic structure for most social scientists working on this habit. You are my, you know, benefactor. I am your beneficiary. Here's this little packet, which is the clear and understandable benefit that passes from you to me. And so I owe you proportionate gratitude for having done me this service, whatever it is. That's the character of gratitude as understood by a whole lot of social scientists nowadays. Let's see. This form of there, but the Thomistic framework certainly covers this kind of gratitude as an aspect of acquired justice. But the basic framework can also be stretched to cover cases in which I'm grateful for opportunities that I enjoy because members of past generations struggled in order to make good possible for my generation. People who never would have known my name, people who didn't know exactly what good would come of the struggles that they were engaged in, this kind of stuff. This sort of gratitude is really common in my neighborhood. I live on the south side of Chicago, kind of the ghetto. A lot of people in my neighborhood talk about the need to give back. This is a really powerful motivator for young people in the neighborhood. They usually mean give back, given the struggles people went through in this for civil rights, okay, that made possible all kinds of things that they would not otherwise have enjoyed. Okay, this form of gratitude, impersonal gratitude, finds cognitive, emotional, motivational, and behavioral expressions, often in my work on behalf of future generations. It gets called moving the good forward, where I have no more idea what the actual fruits of that good are going to be than somebody who died in 1964 knew about what benefits I might enjoy as a result of their struggles. Okay, we can use something of Aquinas on transcendent good to link gratitude connected with the need to give back to my community to gratitude connected with triadic personal benefit. I take it that the most important insight from Aquinas about infused virtue for, by gentlemen's agreement, godless moral philosophy rests in seeing that the infused virtues alter the entire context in which ordinary acquired virtue operates by ordering ordinary virtuous activity to a transcendent good. Right? It's no longer that it's just I've got this huge agenda of stuff I have to do today to be a decent human being, you know? It's like all of that activity is seen as belonging in a context that's oriented to some transcendent good. Okay. I began by pointing out that you don't need revealed knowledge about God in order to appreciate the descriptive accuracy of the phrase darkened intellect, disturbed passions, disordered will as a reasonable diagnosis of how things are with us. I mentioned that I thought that when we make errors in thought, action, judgment, and response, we very often know better, and that the fact that we somehow know better is at least as interesting as the fact that we fail. I mean, especially given that most of us have never met anybody who doesn't fail. So it's not like we're copying what somebody else does. Okay, in this very brief and rapid tour through some of Aquinas' treatment of acquired virtue, I have attempted to use a transformative interpretation of Aquinas on intellect as a way to begin to get at the sense in which we know better, even if the many errors that we make are made routinely by most of the other people with whom we interact. Given his picture of temporal human life, Aquinas develops a strongly corrective account of acquired virtue. I think that even atheist philosophers can embrace the catchphrase diagnosis of the human condition, and since we understand the whole human person as directed to good, we ought to embrace a corrective account of virtue. One other obvious alternative is to follow Aristotle even more closely than we normally do and emphasize that only a handful of exceptionally privileged men can even hope to attain virtue anyway, so widespread disorder is of no interest. It's like hardly anyone is even a candidate for this in Aristotle. Very few contemporary theorists of virtue are willing to follow Aristotle there. The monumental task for mainstream Neo-Aristotelian ethics will come in giving some account of the nature of the good that is supposed to orient the whole human being, and of how it is that something of this good makes itself felt in beings who find themselves in the kind of mess and muddle that apparently is our lot. It is one thing to point out that we see in ourselves an apparently insatiable appetite for some kind of fulfillment that appears to be forever just out of reach. Nothing is easier than amassing anecdotal evidence for some such point. But it is another thing entirely to give an account of the good at issue that is meant to unify both the person and those specific virtues that help steady her aim at this good. The challenge of doing so without adverting to divinity is, I think, immense. Thank you.